such a way that it then exits Pluto in a known direction of another Kuiper belt object. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know two Kuiper belt objects they got in mind. So, wherever they are, must be, I don't think they, in fact, I'm pretty sure they haven't adjusted their trajectory to Pluto because of that. I haven't read that. I think I would have seen that. But I think they, you know, whatever they planned on originally, they're going to stick with. And wherever these Kuiper belt objects are, I guess they know they have quite a bit of fuel on board. They've used a lot less than expected, a lot less mid-course corrections were needed. They do so well at this. So they're going to have enough fuel to probably make whatever adjustments they need to make to get to the Kuiper belt. And I think I just read it something like about a month, probably a couple of weeks ago, they said 150 million miles away, like 1.5 AU left to go to get to Pluto. So, and they're getting there. And some other information I had on that. I don't know, but they're moving along pretty good. I think it's only 1.5 AU left out of the 39. Back to you.
If I compare New Horizons radio-wise to Voyager, is the dish on New Horizons about the same size? Is the frequency the same, 8.4 gigahertz, KU band, or X-band they call it? And is the power output of the transmitter about the same? In other words, do we have reason to believe we will be able to talk to New Horizons at ranges similar to Voyager? And is the nuclear power supply on board believed to last that long? So again, it has the capability of going to the kind of range that Voyager did. Is that possibly in the future, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
I think their antenna was 10 feet in diameter, where Voyager was a little bit bigger, 12. And X-band, 8 point something, you're right. They had another frequency, but that was only used close in. I think that's the main frequency that they're going to use, X-band. And then wattage, I'll have to go back and look. I thought it was 40 watts. I know Voyager was down to like 20 watts. They started off 25 or 30 or something. And it was 30. And this one's probably a little higher to start with. Should be pretty good. I just wanted to bring up Dawn. Dawn is a spacecraft that was launched, I think that was in 2007, went out to an asteroid called Vista and orbited it and then deorbited it, and now it's on its way to Ceres, and that's going to be arriving sometime in 2015. Going, I believe, in March, and going into orbit around Ceres. So, they're the two biggest asteroids out there in the main asteroid belt. So I think that's pretty cool. But, Dawn has the ion engines. Three ion engines. And once it's in orbit around it, you're not going to have an extended mission, but I think it's done a pretty good job orbiting one, deorbiting it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We still have the Eastern repeater. That's good. So as Dawn approaches those two asteroids, one already and another one coming up, lots of scientific measurements, no landing proposed. not even a touchdown, I'm going to guess, Paul. So, and it's not one of these return missions. I don't think it's going to be gathering material and returning. So I guess the main thing Dawn's going to give us is close-up pictures, magnetic field measurements, particles and radiation measurements. What's the major parameters that Dawn has been or will be measuring, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, well, it'll do the same thing that it did around Vista. You know, naturally, close-up pictures. You put Vista into the computer, now you're going to get beautiful close-up pictures that Dawn took during its 1.5 years that it orbited that asteroid. And that's a big asteroid. I think that's like 300 miles in diameter or something. Sirius is even bigger than the one it's going to now. It's probably twice the diameter. So, no planning on landing that. You know, it's a big spacecraft. If you were to stand next to it, it would look like two tractor trailer trucks. It's about 70 feet from one end to the other. You know, because of the solar panels. It takes the 10 kilowatts of power, runs it into the spacecraft to power the ion engines. And of course, you've got fuel on board, Xeon fuel, which has been, you know, I mean, they don't shut these things off. They go on day after day, year after year. It's incredible. Back to you there.
Paul, what is your best guess as to why Dawn used solar panels for power as opposed to an RTG, a nuclear thermal generator? The idea of the nuclear generator, I think, is a little bit lower in mass compared to those great big solar panels. And therefore, the ion engine would give you a little bit more thrust equivalent. So it seems to me like, had they used a nuclear generator, you wouldn't have to be carrying around those great big solar panels, and therefore I'd be getting a little bit more benefit out of the ion engine. Any idea why they didn't go that way, Paul? K2LAW?
Well, at 1 AU, you've got to get 10,000 watts, which you're going to need, like, all the time. And now you get out to the asteroid belt. Of course, that's going to cut way down, you know, at least in half. So, you know, what are you going to get? 4,000, you know, with the inverse square, you're probably going to get 4,000 kilowatts. But you need that all the time to operate the ion engines. Fuel on board is Xeon. They only bought enough fuel, or they put enough fuel on there, whatever they can launch on their Delta II rocket, was launched on their Delta II rocket. And you've got roughly 1,000 pounds of Xeon fuel, and they've already gone through most of that. It took roughly half of it to get to and orbit Vista, and half of whatever was left to get to the new asteroid Sirius, and then for, you know, maintenance, maneuver, different maneuvers that they're going to do around Sirius. They expect to be down to about 40 pounds left. So it's not even enough to leave or have an extended mission. But that's the goal, to do those, you know, both those missions, and to do it with chemical engines. This was out of the question, so they wanted to use ion engines. And all they needed was enough electricity to do that, and those panels, you know, sufficed. I mean, if they were going beyond the asteroid belt, of course, you know, you're not going to get enough light. You'd have to do something different, like your RTGs. Back to you.
mission with Vista, I'm going to guess sometime in 2015. What is proposed for the future beyond that, Paul? Go ahead.
Vista is done with. Spent a year and a half in orbit around that. Because of these ion engines, they were able to break loose of that orbit. And now they're going to go into orbit around Cirrus in March and stay there forever. So, they'll probably continue to get data back from there as long as the electronics hold up. Fuel will eventually run out. And that'll be the end of the mission. No plan, no extended mission to go anywhere else. They don't have enough fuel to even break orbit from that asteroid.
So, after it finishes with Cirrus, it will even have used up enough of its reaction control jet fuel, so it will no longer have the ability to stay oriented with its dish aimed at Earth. Therefore, we won't easily be able to communicate with it. Is that the approximately what the end of life will look like, Paul, K2RIW?
Yeah, with only 40 pounds left. Remember, like I said, it started off with almost 950 pounds of Xeon fuel. Most of that is gone, or will be gone, after it deaccelerates at Cirrus in March. All you have is your reaction control, maybe a magnetometer to your I don't even know if it has them, gyros or anything. you're going to be out of fuel. But, 40 pounds left is a lot probably for another year or two of, orbiting information for that asteroid. So that's what's predicted to be left, around 40 pounds after they orbit, they can finally get into the orbit of that asteroid.
How big is Cirrus, Paul?
I like to do relative sizes. Like Vista is 300 miles in diameter, roughly that. And this is 590, so I call it 600. It's like twice the diameter of Vista. These two asteroids are the biggest asteroids in the whole asteroid belt. They comprise of, their mass is equal to about 7 or 8% of the entire asteroid belt.
Boy, that's a biggie. And how big is that compared to the thing that Rosetta is flying around? Go ahead.
A big difference. That comet is the best one I saw was they compare it. Instead of saying miles, it's roughly 2 miles in diameter. But instead of saying miles, if you were to lay it down on a map down in downtown Manhattan, it would go from the east side to the west side. That's the diameter. You could put that down on a map and go from here to Lake George. Any other thing would go out to 500-600 miles, maybe out to the middle of Pennsylvania somewhere. That's about the best way to think of it. Back to you, Dick.
That is a biggie. And by definition, it's got considerably more gravity. If we landed on that surface, has anybody talked about what magnitude of gravity Cirrus has?
I don't know. I probably read it 10, 20 years ago, and I don't remember. But that could be gotten on the air real quick on the internet. But, the one that Rosetta is flying around, that comet, that 2 mile thing, is, they said, 1 foot per second? And you're gone. You're off that comet. So this is going to be considerably more, of course.
So on man standing on the comet that Rosetta is going around, 67P, with just a moderate-sized jump, he's at escape velocity. Whereas on Cirrus, my guess is a man might not be able to jump off with escape velocity. What do you think, Paul?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you're right. You know, to consider it, it's really like a planetism almost. This is part of the argument for Pluto, I think it was. Pluto's 1,300 miles in diameter. I think I got that right. But, you know, they would say, they said, well, if we're going to consider Pluto a planet, we should consider Cirrus a planet. You know, it's close enough. It's round. It's not egg-shaped. It doesn't look like a potato like 67P. So that's how this whole planet thing got all found. I mean, even Vista, Vista's round too. It's a sphere. So you know, to attain that shape, to become a sphere, it needs enough gravitational pull to do that. That's why the other ones look like potatoes, because they don't have that mass to pull everything into an equal sphere.
Does Cirrus or Vista have any satellites, Paul?
We don't know about Cirrus yet. They looked for satellites, and that was one of the things that they looked for as Dawn was orbiting Vista for a year and a half, and they didn't find any.
So it's not quite big enough to have a satellite, but it is big enough to be round. It's not big enough to sweep clean its orbit around the sun. So for a couple of reasons, it doesn't qualify as a planet. Pluto, I guess, is not considered cleaning up its path, but it's got satellite and it's round. Boy, it's coming awful close to being a planet, isn't it, Paul? K2RAW.
Yeah, I concur. Well, there was one that was kind of like egg-shaped. Was it Matilda? And it had a little moon going around it. They called it Ida, IDA. I'll have to look that up. Hope I got that right. Remember, this is the TechNet. We could get it wrong. Practically.
Is Cirrus the largest asteroid?
Yes, it is. And it was discovered, what, early 1800s, I remember that. I don't remember when that was discovered, but I remember that Cirrus is the largest.
Is the orbit of Cirrus somewhere between Mars and Jupiter? And is it a somewhat circular orbit? Go ahead.
Yeah, Mars, I think, is 1.6 AU, and this is a little further. Course. Yeah, it's in the asteroid belt. There's probably millions of these things, and to think about how big this is, and it's amazing to think that another 90% is floating around in little pieces between Jupiter and Mars. What they think is the results of an unformed planet due to the gravitational pull of Jupiter.
So, in theory, there could have been another small planet between Mars and Jupiter. It didn't quite form. All the stuff left over is the asteroid belt. And I presume there is no asteroid belt between Jupiter and Saturn. Is that true, Paul?
No, you just have some asteroids that are stuck in the Trojan position, you know, the L4 and L5 position of Jupiter. There are some there, but that's it. There's no other belt. You got the asteroid belt. Beyond that, you have the Kuiper belt. That's beyond, of course, the Pluto distance. And then a sphere completely surrounding everything in our solar system. You have the Oort cloud, cloud is spherical in nature. It's not along the ecliptic like the asteroid belt or the Kuiper belt.
Do you know the approximate number of astronomical units to the Kuiper belt? Do you know the approximate number of astronomical units to the Oort cloud, spherical Oort cloud? Over to you, Paul.
Well, you can go up to, 80, or all the way up to 100 AU, I think, for the, up to that distance for the Kuiper belt. But that starts, probably, maybe 40, 42 AU, soon after Pluto's distance. And then the Oort cloud is, that extends all the way to, maybe one-third of the distance between here and the next star, which is Alpha Centauri. So that's, you could go all the way out to 40,000 AU, I think it is, something like that.
Way out there. A lot of stuff. And we used to think we're the center of everything. And there's a lot of stuff going around our particular mediocre-sized star. But we're just one of 200 billion stars in this galaxy, 150,000 light years in diameter. And this galaxy is just one of a whole bunch of galaxies called the Local Galactic Group. And that's just a tiny little section of the observable universe of 100,000 galaxies. And you guys have heard
center of everything. We're the center of arrogance. That's about everything.
That's it, John. You got it. Let me drop.
Oh, by the way, radio distance to horizon is around almost 5 hours now.
5 hours one way, I'm guessing. So it's 10 hours round trip. So in other words, you say hello to horizon, new horizon, and 10 hours later you get a hello back. Is that roughly it, Paul?
Yes, it's not quite 5 hours yet, but it's 4.5 or 4 hours, something like that. I wanted to bring that up before, because that's amazing, considering that, that sounds like, wow, that's far, speed of light. Here's Voyager out there at 130 AU. It takes 34.5 hours, something, for radio waves go in one direction. That's amazing.
I thought Voyager's around 18 hours one way and 36 hours round trip. I thought the 36 hours to Voyager was round trip. Do you believe that might be one way, Paul? Therefore, 72 hours round trip? Go ahead.
Getting late. Round trip. 34 hours, I think it was.
Has anyone ever talked about the approximate lifetime of New Horizons? Are we at least in the talking phase of maybe using it for the next 20 years, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, they're going to follow that all the way out. Yeah, it'll outlive us. until the RPG quits or the thermocouples quit, that are part of the RPG. Or some radio component burns out, or one of the two traveling wave tubes quit, or something goes wrong with the ability to steer the spacecraft. They'll be talking 20, 30 years from now, they'll be talking about it or talking to it.
So you said the magic word of my next question. A pair of traveling wave tubes running at X-band. So here is a 2006 launch, and the best transmitter they could think of is a traveling wave tube that didn't go solid state. Just think about the fact that way back in 1985, in the middle of the B-1B bomber program, progressive thinking people said, it's time we stop using tubes. Let's make the highest power, highest frequency transmitter solid state instead of traveling wave tubes. They wanted a hell of a lot more power than 20 watts. hell of a lot more frequency range than just X-band, and they wanted to do that solid state with 1985 technology. And I remember telling anybody who would listen, you guys are way out of line on this one. On paper it sounds good, if you understand the technology available in 1985. Even though you've got this huge program and you think you've got a great big pocket full of money and you think you're going to make these really high power transmitters on really broad frequency ranges, all solid states. Wow. They didn't stand a chance. A fair amount of money was wasted doing a number of research programs to try to switch over those TWT transmitters to solid state. Boy, was that a waste. And now here we are, that was 85. Here we are almost 30 years later, and we're still using a traveling wave tube for a narrow band frequency region of X-band at a moderately low power compared to jamming transmitters. A jamming transmitter is many times higher in power, many times broader in frequency range. And solid state ain't there yet, in my opinion, Paul. The closest thing that I see is that Eric will tell us about the solid state broadcast transmitters. But that's at frequencies like 700 megacycles. You try to build that kind of power at, let me pick a number, 16 gigahertz. Wow. Over to you, Paul, for comment on this. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I remember looking that up a couple of years ago because we used to talk about the traveling wave tubes. You gave a very good explanation of what they were years ago. Turns out, yeah, the new Horizons got two of them. And I just looked up the Voyager 1, by the way. 36 hours, 13 minutes round trip for Voyager 1.
36 hours and 13 minutes and counting, increasing. This time next year, it'll be probably, what, 37 hours up all dead?
Sometimes it drops a little bit, you know. Because when we're talking about radio waves, so we're talking about it from Earth to the spacecraft. As the Earth goes around, sometimes it increases or decreases, depending on which way we're moving. And we're moving 60,000 miles an hour around the sun. The spacecraft is moving away from the sun at roughly 40,000. Miles per hour, so at some point we're accelerating toward the spacecraft at 20,000 miles an hour, and sometimes we're moving away from it 40,000 miles an hour faster. So outside of that, in general, on average, it's going away, and it's definitely increasing. Back to you.
Sounds like it ain't going to come back home, Paul. I think it's out of this world, out of the solar system. For all practical purposes, if you consider the solar system, the planets. But have they talked about when it will leave the Kuiper Belt? I presume Voyager is sort of well into the Kuiper Belt. Has anyone ever mentioned when it might possibly leave the Kuiper Belt and go beyond the pole? Go ahead.
Now, like we were saying before, how far does the Kuiper Belt really extend? And if it's, you know, if it's even twice that distance of where it is now, you know, you've got another 20, 30 years. You know. Some of these planetesimal things that they've discovered, like Sedna and planets like that are 80 or 90 AU. This thing's 130. Where's the end of the Kuiper Belt? I don't know yet. Back to you there.
The nice thing about Voyager is it's so far away from the sun now that the rate its speed is slowing down is very little. So on the next transmission, you're going to tell me how fast in miles per hour, you already did, but you're going to repeat it for me, How many thousand miles per hour away from the sun is Voyager 1 moving? And if your number was, I'll pick a number, 35,000 miles an hour right now, my guess is a year from now it'll still be going 34,000 miles an hour. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know both of them are about 40,000, 39 and 38,000 miles per hour, something like that. But, of course, Voyager 1 is the furthest one away. It's almost 130 AU. It's 129.8. And Voyager 2 is a lot closer. That's 106. 100, going on 107 AU. they're roughly 39,000 miles per hour going away from the sun. New Horizon, when it's out that far, they said will be about 8,000 miles an hour slower, so that's about 30,000 miles per hour, some years from now.
And what is New Horizons doing right now in speed, Paul?
I think it's a little over 30,000 miles an hour, something like that. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's roughly 8,000 miles per hour slower than the Voyager.
But what I was saying before is that when you're that far away from the sun, the amount of solar gravity you're feeling is so little that the rate at which they're slowing down is quite small. So if a Voyager 1 is doing 38,000 miles an hour now, it's going to be doing a healthy 37,000 miles an hour a year from now. It's really moving out. Fantastic. And I think Voyager 1 stopped using transmitting tube, traveling wave tube number 1, and it's on the backup tube number 2. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, there was something like that, but I don't remember if that was Voyager 1 or 2. I don't know. I know redundancy was really built into both these spacecraft, or all of them. In fact, the spacecraft themselves was redundant. In case one failed, they had the other one. they stopped thinking like that as time went on. That's why New Horizon is only one of them. They thought like that with the Mars landers, the Opportunity and Spirit. That was good. They had two. They only had one Curiosity, although they're building another one. That'll be 2020, the 2020 Mars rover. And, it's unbelievable. But New Horizon, there's only one of them. I would have liked to see two. Suppose one failed. I do know.
So from now on, it's going to be taking pictures, making measurements. So it has done its last hibernation. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, like I was saying, I think there were 18, I had read 18 different times it hibernated. And even in hibernation, though, I think once a week they send a quick message to the Deep Space Network saying I'm okay, equipment's okay. This way, it also allows the Deep Space Network to do other work. For instance, help out Rosetta, to work with Cassini around Saturn, all these other deep space missions. They got their hands full with Deep Space Network. There's only so much they can do.
In the case of Voyager, it is almost a QRP transmitter, something in the vicinity of 6 or 10 watts, and billions of miles away, 130 astronomical units. So therefore, in order to get that extremely minuscule signal over that distance, you're using a 240-foot dish at Goldstone, a state-of-the-art MESA or parametric amplifier, as sensitive as you can get. And even then, you're going down to numbers like of 50 bits per second, very slow data rate, very narrow transmission bandwidth in order for that to work. In the case of the spacecraft, let me drop it. It doesn't have a super low noise gallium arsenide, indium phosphide field effect transistor with super low noise figure, because those things are extremely vulnerable to radiation and impulse noise, static electric noise, and whatever. You don't put one of those on board a spacecraft. You don't put a parametric amplifier or a Mesa amplifier. If someone told me it's got a mixer diode front, I'd believe it. It probably has a moderately high receiver noise figure. And you make that up on the uplink by using a 10 kilowatt transmitter into a 240 foot dish in order to transmit to the uplink to make sure it hears you. I am guessing, Paul, that most of the uplink transmissions to Voyager are done by the Goldstone dish, the 240 foot dish. Is that true, Paul? KTRLAW?
I would think so, but I don't see why they can't transmit from Canberra or Madrid, and the other deep space network complexes. I would think they could transmit from there as well. Am I looking at the time right? Do we got 2 minutes left? This is WS to end.
Your time is right, and you're right, Paul. I am guessing that they use Goldstone more frequently than Spain or Australia, the other three sites with a 240-foot dish for the deep space network. The reason for that is you want to be double down sure that whatever transmissions you give to it in the uplink, where you're giving it commands, you don't want one single bit of error. Because if you put the wrong kind of data in the uplink, and the thing decides to point itself in some other direction because you gave it a glitch in that data, you'll never talk to it again. In order for you and I to transmit data to Spain or to Australia and worry about the bit error rate in the transmission there and then the bit error rate in that uplink to Voyager, you're doubling the risk. For those reasons, I am guessing that uplink is coming from California most of the time, unless they're super busy. But here we go. So, this was TechNet number 1533 of the series. I think we'll be back next week. I'll pass it over to John for some final comments, and then if we get a little bit of time left over on the transmitter, we'll pick up Rich N2EO. KC2WGB. K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Interesting net. A lot of good data. And, yep, God willing, we'll be here next week, and maybe we'll finally resolve all this stuff, and we don't have to have the net anymore. What do you say to that? Back to you, Dick.
Almost those exact words. Almost those exact words were spoken by me and HIP way back in 1982. You see the way this worked out. Bye-bye, you all. Hey, your eyes up, you clear. See you guys next week. Be kind to each other.
73, John. Dick, have a good night. Good night, WS2 and clear. Well, good night, Wesley. And we'll catch you guys next week.
for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
I always used to
throw Chevron Techron cleaner in every now and then. But you know what? I never had fantastic results with that stuff. You never knew if it did its job or not. The Seafoam, I used that with the motorcycle, and you can actually quantitatively see the difference between dirty and clean when you run it through the tank. Works good on finicky lawnmowers too.
Okay, I'll keep it in mind. So you say periodically you throw Seafoam into your vehicles?
I haven't done it in the Avenger in a while, but I also last week filled up at a different gas station than I normally fill up at, so that's why I kinda was gravitating towards possibly having some contaminated fuel.
Ah, that could be the reason. Well, between the Seafoam filling up the tank with gas from a reliable dealer and clearing the code, let's see if it comes back on.
It may take a little while because you got to do a drive cycle before everything comes back in online and everything. Some things are only checked once per drive, you know, once per ignition cycle. Other things are continuous, stuff like that. But what this was is it's a code based on the computer keeping the air-fuel mixture adjusted correctly. And one of the sensors was telling the computer that I guess it was running lean, so that would make it richen the mixture up, which would kill your gas mileage and cause your catalytic converter to run hotter than it's supposed to run. So didn't want to leave that one running for too long. Enter PPN Mobile. Where are you? I'm just passing the repeater.
I got a late start. I'm still on the Meadowbrook.
Everything was moving good. Just a little brake check around the turn at the four-laner into the three-laner. Other than that, everything seems to be running smooth.
Okay. Just keep the box of thumbtacks closed, please.
Yeah, I'll consider it. I'll consider it. The fun part was that I had given Sonny Boy my wired connection for the car. You know, you plug the cable into the onboard diagnostic connector under the dashboard and then plug it into your laptop. So I had a Wi-Fi one and a Bluetooth one. And I remembered that I always had grief with the Wi-Fi one, so I didn't bother with that one. And the Bluetooth one was giving me aggravation because I forgot how to set it all up so that the laptop could talk to the car. So that took me like an hour to figure that one out. But then once I figured it out and got it up and running, then it's like just slap the little module in, like that little progressive quick check or whatever it is that they've got, and then you could sit with the laptop on the seat and do whatever you gotta do.
I assume you have a program that reads and interprets the codes.
I have several different ones. One of them I like because if you want, you can have it record and read your car for whatever the determined amount of time is that you want, and then it'll generate a 6-page report telling you everything that's going on with the car, what all the sensor values are, all the monitored systems. It'll give you the minimum, the maximum, and the average setting for every sensor during the test period. It's a nice little piece of reference information to keep tucked away if you're ever troubleshooting something.
You dropped the thumbtacks, didn't you? I just came into the four laner and I'm down to 15 miles per hour.
That wasn't me. Wasn't me. If it makes you feel any better, I got a heavy brake check over here coming up on the Cross Island.
All right. I spent some time on Friday getting the RAV new shoes.
Very good. Very good. Where'd you go? Schmavis?
No, I went to STS like I usually do up on the turnpike.
Yes. Somerset Tire Shops.
When I got the first set of tires at 50,000 miles for the car, I complained to them. They said that the factory tires did not have a decent bite in snow. Can you give me something with a little more aggressive tread? So they gave me some Firestone, I think they're called Destinations. I went in Friday, I said, I like that tire, is it still around? They said, well, we got the Destination L2s now, and the cars are running quieter.
See, sometimes aggressive tread is noisy, so you gotta kind of cross that line between noisy and good grip.
Well, hopefully they perform in the snow like their predecessors did, because I had no problems.
Yeah, I have a feeling the Toxic Avenger's gonna be needing tires by the end of the winter. I got at least one noisy one in the back. And I've been noticing lately, in wet weather, I can break the front tires loose a lot easier than I used to be able to.
Well, I got a match set, put all four on, and we'll see how these go. The Destinations gave me 60,000, so it's a 60,000 mile rated tire. I was almost down to the wear bars. When I had the oil changed, I had them take a look at my tires, and I had the garage tell me what they thought, and they said, theoretically, you might make it through most of the winter. You're going to need them in a couple of months, but I would change it before the weather sets in.
Don't know what we're looking forward to weather-wise this winter. Everybody seems to have a different opinion on whether we're going to have a lot of the white stuff or not, so we'll have to see.
Well, let's see, either I spend the money now or I spend the money in the middle of the winter. This way I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I hear you. Oh, we did a little holiday decorating yesterday. And to PPN Mobile, by the way, we did a little holiday decorating yesterday. And while I was hanging some lights and stuff from the gutters in the front of the house, I'm like, oh, I'll be right back. I took a run up to Lowe's, and I bought three packages of the gutter screws. And I pulled the nails out that were holding the gutters on and replaced them with the screws, because all the nails were loose. And the gutters were a little droopy, and I'm like, yeah, that's all we need is one good snowfall, and the gutters will be off the house, and I'll be cursing and yelling and screaming. So I replaced all the screws, all the nails with screws on my gutters on the front of the house, so at least I won't have to worry about the ice, snow, or whatever ripping them off.
You had the old Spike and Ferrell routine?
I mean, served me fine for all these years, never had a problem. Spike and Ferrell, so now I have Screw and Ferrell.
Yeah, the gutter system I have can only go up with screws. There's no Spike and Ferrell. I've got that system where it's got the built-in rain cap.
Plus, I also spent the time cleaning all the leaves and stuff out of the front gutters. I should get to the back ones, although we're gonna, if I get home early enough today, I'll try to do it, because I know we got some heavy rains coming, and if I get out 90% of all the leaf debris and all that stuff, then the rainwater will just wash all the sand and roof pebbles and stuff down the drain. I won't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's the nice the nice part about the gutter system I have. It's very difficult for leaves to get into them because I got the leaf guard system. It actually does work.
Back, I used to have the leaf guard, but when they did the roof, they took it all off. If I want to spend the time to put the leaf guard back in the back. The only reason I did that was because of the low slope, the low pitch of that roof, and we have the trees back there. I always used to wind up having considerable amount of leaves in the gutters. So I did that, and it cut it down, but it never really eliminated it. I always, at least once every 18 months or so, had to take the gutter guard off and get the hose up there and wash all the CRUD down the drain.
Well, that's the system where you basically have some sort of screening that's going over the top of the U-shaped channel, the gutter itself. That's not what I have. This is all one piece. You cannot remove it. There is a cap, so the water enters from the side, not the top. The cap has a gentle curve on it, so it brings the water by surface tension, brings it into the gutter itself. And it actually works.
You've opened it up after it's been in place for a while and you've looked and spotless inside?
It's clean. I've had these gutters now for about 10 years or more. One gutter I had to clean. That was it.
Cool. Was this a DIY or you hired someone to come in and do your gutters?
Hired someone. I specifically hired a dealer that was licensed to do these because it's a totally different dye for the aluminum.
What he's to die for, huh?
Well, you've seen how they make the continuous gutters. They have a big roll of aluminum in the back of the truck, and they force it through a folding die.
I wanted to hear my horoscope on Z100, so I tuned you out for a minute.
Was it horrible?
A is an 8.
So if you wanted to get an idea of what this gutter system looks like, when the gutter is off the building, you've got a vertical piece that's perfectly flat that would normally go up against your fascia board. Extend that up a little bit higher, have it make a, not a right angle bend, actually a more than 90 degree bend, so it's got a downward slope, and then run that piece of aluminum till it's parallel with the front face of the gutter, and then put a gentle 90 degree curve on that, so as the water hits the top of the gutter, it runs along the top slope and then runs around the curve and drops into the 5-inch gutter.
I've seen the leaf guard stuff before. I just, when we were doing our gutters years and years and years ago, it just never, occurred to me to price it out. I may wind up having to replace the gutters anyway, because when the guys did my roof, they mangled them up a bit, which is probably why they were a little looser than they normally were. Out of all of the spikes, I think only two of them were in solid, and I had to work to get them out.